I know this sounds silly when I say it.
Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most ducker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host, BL of All Souls Podcast. I'm joined by Adam Camilleri.
Evening, everybody.
Red Powell and Tanya Gates.
Hello.
Hey, everybody.
Well, welcome to the show. Going to be talking about how to beat Necrons, which is
impossible.
Well, if you're playing them, is what it seems like.
Unless it's another Necron player. I'm just kidding.
And also about maybe how to get a club going, how to get like a team or foster an environment that you want to be a part of in your local area. That's something that, you know, it's nothing. It's important to talk about every now and then. It's certainly something we've chatted about before on the show. But, you know, things have changed. But it's almost like a whole different world out there in the hobby environment, hobby stores, tournaments and whatnot. Things coming on and off of lockdown. Like, how do you keep a scene alive?
Yeah, really good topic. It's actually sent in by a mate of mine who asked me personally. And I was like, oh, man, that's just a perfect. That is some perfect FTN goodness right there. And I asked him if he minded us putting it on the show. And yeah, it's like, how do you go about like not only starting a team or a club, keeping momentum, keeping things alive and bubbling and melding ideologies or expectations to different things. I love the idea of it.
We might even roll out a hobby segment in this episode. Going to cover all the goodness. Where do y'all want to start?
Well, I think the team one sounds like a great one to kick off with.
Did your buddy have some specific questions or some specific struggles that may have been happening?
No, so when it comes down to it, right? I mean, I the prompt is pretty good because it's important because this is a community-based game. This game cannot endure. It can. You very much can play by yourself in your basement, but I think that it's a much lesser version of what it really is when you have a thriving community, a thriving positive community, right? And so with that, I mean, I'd say I don't have the ability or the fortune to have a large, extremely close-knit community everywhere I go with the Army. However, I will say that I've been rather very fortunate with the U.S. Army Esports deal to say that I do have a much broader community, a broader team that I can participate. And so with that, there's a couple things that I think go into that. And one of those is you really have to have a driving force, and it can't just be one person. It has to be a group of people that have this desire to want to get out there and actually play games. And even if that's local and it's you've got house rules or what have you, that's one thing, right? I think it's important to have that because you can find a comfort zone that you all appreciate and that you're all playing into. While there's you know, Crusade and the competitive method, there's other games, other GW games, other tabletop games out there, what have you. You just got to find some common ground that you're all on the same page with, because that's what's going to keep you coming back to a certain extent, right? Is that you have that common ground, you're comfortable, and you can play through it. And then I'd say once you really have something like that developed with a team and you all agree to it, I think we can all say we've seen a lot of different teams grow up over time, right? We saw the development of Beast Coast. We saw the development of Brohammer. We've seen the development of, you know, now Art of War. And there's different teams all throughout. And at ATC, you get a really good chance to see how a lot of that has materialized into these different aspects. And I think that's a really big point. And then you also get to see some of the other avenues of team building, like the WTC and other aspects and where those teams come about. But it goes back to having this common ground and this community drive that plays into it. And really the third thing, which I already highlighted, is having events, these events that you go to, whether it's these local events for each other that kind of pull everyone into the game, or you're taking the team out to the bigger events like ATC, the Las Vegas team tournament, WTC, or you're just going to events together and playing, you know, solo, man, you know, person in person, individually, but still it's a team effort of going out and showing up. And you see that in a lot of events. You go, you look at some of the more regional events, and that's, it's a lot of times it's highlighted more so by a group of people who consistently play together. And you see where that team kind of has some prominence just in presence alone. And so I've hit three big, really, you know, three things that I think are important, but I'll pause there to let everyone else take a breath and speak.
Well, you mentioned playing together, and it doesn't necessarily always just have to be that, you know, especially with us,
true,
you know, people moving around, but interacting and living in the hobby together, even if it's bouncing list ideas off of and still having that connection. I think when we talk about clubs and teams, it's about establishing a connection to something, and it could be to the hobby, it could be to the game store, it could be to the people. There's lots of things, but I think there's how you do it and what you engineer towards, it is about establishing that connection.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the specific question by the gentleman, he stated, hey, a few mates and I have been to some tournaments together. And I'm toying with the idea of starting a team. We aren't looking to shake the leaderboards, but do you have any advice on how many plays make a good team and any do's or don'ts? I think you've hit on some really amazing ones there, Red. Find the common ground that brought you together in the first place and wanted you to be on a team with these people, and then build off that. If that is going to events, as this gentleman, the person who pointed the question, so you met these guys at tournaments. So a team that plays together stays together, as far as I'm concerned. So sign up to a team event together.
Like, yeah, sign up. Yeah. And about, like, and what is a good number of people? Like, there, that would help determine if let's say the ATC is five-person tournaments, you don't want just five folks in your club. You want seven, because a couple people are probably not going to make it.
Yeah.
Like a D&D yeah. game, you know?
Yeah, and at the same time, like, if you want to be on a team with these people because they have amazing hobby, they're up in hobby track, you aspire to learn off them, and you like what they bring to it, and hobby is what brought you together. I don't know, start a Discord, start, like, hobbying together one night a week for, like, an hour or two. Like, do the things that brought you together. Like, so many parts of our hobby are associated with an activity, and if the activity that you share is the reason you want to be on a team with them, build the team around that. Don't be like, oh, we love painting, let's go to the crunchiest, most hard-nosed, you know, tournaments we can together. That doesn't make much sense, does it? I mean, do that as well if that's what you want to do. But building your team around that is a modus operandi.
Win those hobby track awards.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but exactly right. If that's the thing, go and do that. But yeah, yeah. Identifying why you want to be on a team with them, I think, is a good place to start.
I agree with that. And this next thing I'm going to say might sound silly, but I'm going to say it anyway. And I actually, and this is, like, I fully believe this. Get yourself a logo, and then y'all get some shirts or some hoodies made.
I love that. Get an identity.
Yeah.
That's actually a great point.
Cool t-shirts. You're like, oh, this is now our gaming shirt. We're going to roll this out when we go to the stores, or when we're going to a tournament. Like, oh, people start going, oh, you know so-and-so. Yeah. And it starts to point a dialogue. Again, going back to that, kind of establishing that connection is a cool thing. It's pretty kind of a low-cost thing, too. Like, I already know we got tons of stuff to buy in this hobby already. But, you know, cool t-shirts. Who doesn't want a nice little t-shirt with some personalization on it?
Yeah. One of the big do's for me, and I suppose it wraps into the point I was saying before, is set expectations. Like, what kind of team or club are you? Are you ultra competitive team? If you are, then that kind of informs how many people are going to be in your team in the first place, because you're only going to want people of a certain, you know, whatever. Or if you're a team that wants to smash the hobby track, that informs you as well. You know, you want people who enjoy painting. Not, don't necessarily have to have beautifully painted armies, but are going to enjoy the journey and
they,
pushing to get.
They want to interact with that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The members, whatever in your Discord, I think Discord or something like that is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Have even a Facebook group or a Discord or whatever where people can contribute to, and you know, when the inspiration or moment strikes them, they could send a message, eliciting some response, some interactivity.
How do you vet somebody for a team in our hobby? Like, how do you be like, do you want to be like, do we want this person on our team, or this person wants to join? What do we think? Because that conversation does happen. It's not always, it's not something we sometimes like to talk about, because it brings us back to maybe some, you know, memories of being the last one chosen for a sports team in high school or something, or things of that nature. People discussing your virtues. But it's a conversation that happens, and I don't want to shy away from it. You guys got any insights?
With this hobby, you know, we talk about often that sometimes playing on the tabletop is the least amount of time that we invest in this. We're building, We're talking about it. We're painting, you know, we're out to dinner with some folks that we met at the tournament or whatever. So I think you've got to, when you're evaluating, unless it's a specific built for purpose, we want to go into this tournament and score the most points in XYZ category or whatever, you really want to focus. I think people are candidates if you enjoy spending your time with them.
I personally, I've not been on a team before, but in regards to vetting people, I think it's a good idea to have either a formal or informal kind of code of conduct for yourselves and ask yourselves, can this person follow the code of conduct, right? So like if you have an unspoken code of conduct that's like, we don't talk trash about other teams that we don't know or something like that, right? Can this person adhere to that? If they can't, I think that that's probably like an automatic no. They can't be part of the team, right? Like if their past behavior shows that they can't adhere to your code of conduct, then they're probably not going to be a good fit for you. It may just cause problems.
No doubt that you become associated with the other folks and you're, you know, I talk about, you know, especially if you're walking around with t-shirts. One of my first grand tournament, dude, I was playing, zeroed me on sportsmanship because he didn't like someone else in my club.
Oof.
You know, and that this behavior doesn't really happen much anymore kind of thing, but that was... You know, that was certainly something that can happen. So you're right. The ideals of nothing can prevent that, you know, that kind of thing. But I think you're spot on there with identifying the ideals of, you know, what is valuable to you, which you consider great, and then seeing that in other people that would be potential teammates or club members.
Red, is there any qualifications or anything you need required to join the Army esports team? Like what do you guys set up?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, in fact, you know, awesome time at the Lone Star Open recently with military appreciation. There were several people who were interested in joining, and it's a pretty easy point when I put it out there that it's three simple things. The first one is honestly probably the least important, and that is getting out there and playing the game, being competitive to a degree, because being competitive in a tempered way, in a balanced way, is healthy for a community. We talk about that drive and wanting to get better at it and play the game and do well. We've talked about how everybody wants to win, right? Like that's kind of an inherent part of it. But being able to appreciate the challenge that comes through the tactical capability of the game and everything, it's a whole part of it. So there, you have to have that to a certain degree. Now, that doesn't mean that you always have to win. You always have to go out there and do well. That's not what I'm saying. You just have to have some of that drive to it. The next two parts are really much bigger, and it plays into exactly what we were just talking about in regards of like the community standards code of conduct piece, is that the second one is you have to be someone that people want to come back and play another game with. That's a key part of the structure and the community and what we do for the U.S. Army esports team and our community outreach is why would we want someone who people don't want to play another game with, right? That's a complicated aspect because, you know, if you're too competitive and you don't know how to foster community or how to help bring people up and sustain it in a friendly, you know, manner, developing this kind of competitive camaraderie, then, you know, it's a struggle to go into that next part that I just highlighted. And then finally, you've got to be someone of integrity, and having that integrity and owning, you know, if you make a mistake, you make a mistake. If being honest and upfront and demonstrating that kind of character to others, right? Because integrity, you can hear a lot of different definitions. One of them is, you know, doing the right thing when no one's looking kind of deal. And for all of us, we can talk about how big of an aspect that is to some of what we do, because we don't have a computer just determining all of our dice rolls for us or anything like that. When you do something like that and you take it to that point, there's a little bit of, you know, also the purpose of the esports team specifically is trying to get out there and demonstrate ourselves as members of the community. So there's something to, you know, being willing to do that. But really those first three I mentioned, I think were crucial to the better character of our community and what we were trying to do for the greater community as a whole, if that makes sense.
Man, makes a heaps of sense. Is there been any credence given to the size of the team? Like, do you think, this is too many, this is not enough, or it doesn't matter, more the merrier?
So, you know, and I think we've seen the debate, right, where people wanted to kind of bring the clubs in, the ITC teams, and like limit the numbers and everything. What I've really appreciated is that one, it's that it hasn't been limited and that anybody could join underneath the banner, because for us, it really is about making it as big as possible, because of the presence and going to be able to go anywhere in the country, you know, the United States and in some places abroad. And to be able to run into one of our peers amongst the community is really awesome. I mean, just even Lone Star Open this last weekend, I ran into several people that I'd never met before. And it was so awesome because we've talked via Discord. We've seen each other in the Black and Gold Wargaming community. And we've seen some of our work and we've seen the names, but we've never really had the opportunity to shake hands and put the physical face to that name. And so the ability to show up at Lone Star Open and run into three people that I've never met physically before, but I've engaged with was immensely rewarding for me, and being able to the value that I have for the community, because we're able to have that interconnectedness between each other and really show up wherever and do that. It's awesome. And that's where I would say in some cases, you know, it's very cool to have your smaller team, your crew, right? Especially if depending on your goals and what you're trying to do, but always having that willingness to engage and jump into other communities, because there were a lot of people that it was just so awesome to get to know and get to meet at every event I go to, that I never want to just limit myself down to just the one team or community. I want to be able to engage and have a good time with everybody there, because you know, you're going to run into a lot of these folks again. You're going to. It's just inevitable. You're going to play a game with them over and over at some point, just depending on where you go. And so I think it's in your best interest to build that infrastructure, that community infrastructure of goodwill amongst each other, and to be able to promote one another, and because other people, you know, they're trying to run events, they've got, you know, just even like what we're doing right now with Forge the Narrative, the ability to go to events and meet people who are able to listen. You know, if you're out there, you're able to listen to the show, we appreciate it so much for participating in it. This is a community. We are all part of a community right now, and I won't underestimate the value that I personally have in that. And I know I've seen it in others, and I sincerely appreciate that they do too. I think I really ran away with your question there, Adam. I think I answered it nonetheless.
You did. You smashed it.
Yeah, nice. Get shirts. Get to plan. Find folks with similar ideals. There's nothing wrong with being like driven for a particular purpose either. It could just be to have a solid team event, a 4-person team event. You want to go into Adepticon and create a dynasty. We'll get you and three of your buddies.
Yep. Play a lot of Necrons, you know, dynasties. Hey, put a boom, ow.
Yeah, walked into that one. That's
that's your one, Adam. There's no more.
That's my one.
you don't even get that, but we'll give you this now.
Love it. What about clubs? A team makes a lot more sense to keep it small, keep it tight. A club to me like means a shared activity. It means like you have a club day. It means you have like something you're built around. There's a club I am starting to frequent. They're on every Thursday night, but it's at a pub in the western suburbs of Melbourne, and I get down there once a month, and I coincide attending that club when doing a lot of base coding on models, like the arduous crap job of getting all my base coats nice.
The hobby
and okay.
Chore that you
yes, and it goes faster when I'm hanging out with mates, having a meal, talking some nonsense. Like, it always goes faster and it's a more pleasurable experience than me just sitting staring at my models. And so I always line that up. And so me, like, that's what that club feel is. It's to make it going and doing that with my peers, it makes the arduous not arduous. And so to me, that's like that club feel and identity. That's what I identify with. Is there any differences of starting a club to starting a team?
I think the same principles apply. With a team, you get that idea that it is more results driven. Like, it just labeling it a team, I think, is more results driven. And with a club, maybe there's less obligation, you know,
yep,
pressure maybe for a result. But I don't know, they're too far away from each other. They're definitely cousins if not direct siblings.
Yeah, I can see that. The code of conduct thing is like how staunch do you need to be on that? Like, is there a, I suppose, not to make this too army esports centric, but it's pretty poignant that we've got the head of a, you know, a national team with us, well, international team. Is there a, you know, I don't want to talk punitively, but is there, you know, consequences to negative actions? Like, if you it is found that somebody gave somebody a bad experience and they represented your team, like, what do you do?
Yeah, so I mean, and I think it's first important to highlight, like, for those of us and many of in the U.S. Army or the services at large that have served, there's a professional capacity to it for those that are serving or have served. And when you're a professional, part of what falls in the definition of being a professional is being able to police yourselves, right? To uphold that professional standard. And so with that, it becomes important that that carries through in all things that we do, because a profession is not just something you do as a job, right? There is a difference between a profession and a job. And so for us, it's part of who we are. It's part of our lifestyle. And so we have values that we're upheld to. And to get to your question, there's something we need to do when we find members of our team that aren't within those values, that have strayed from that path. And there's ways to go about it. And in a lot of cases, especially with what we're doing here, and I'd say by and large for just my approach personally, there's a lot of development to be done. It is not something that I think a hammer is the right tool in dealing with, because you're dealing with people and there's a lot of different circumstances involved. It's not just cut and dry in so many words, but it is important to maintain that professional standard. Because again, we talk about the community and what's bringing us together, and that's part of it. That's part of our infrastructure. And so with that, we have to hold each other accountable for that. And how we go about that is important, because you want to, in my opinion, you want to make people better, right? You don't want to tear them down. With it being community focused, you want to explain what happened, what went wrong. And I'll say that, you know, we've had instances of this where you highlight, well, this is the issue and this is what we can't accept. We do not accept this, whatever occurred that may have stepped outside of the realm of our professional standards. And so I believe that that's where you offer an opportunity to learn and develop. I think that that's where you highlight something and you say, this is the case. And so in the code of conduct, you know, walking things through, a lot of times a yellow card or a red card, as we see in the ITC code of conduct, there should be some developmental efforts done in conjunction with what you're doing, right? It's not just the referee on the soccer field or football field saying, you know, all right, yellow card or flag or what have you. It should be, hey, look, this happened. You made a mistake. You still have the opportunity to continue and do, you know, well and prosper and make the most of things. But we gave you a warning because of this, this, and this. And so we, you know, it's something that we ask, or, you know, simply just don't do it again, because it has these impacts. And I can't say for sure. I mean, even in a lot of cases with myself, that I've always taken the time that I probably should have to elaborate and explain why that doesn't work. Because, you know, not everybody comes from the same background where they're offered the opportunities to learn from those mistakes, nor are they offered the opportunities to understand the impacts of those mistakes or those actions. And so, again, there's a whole aspect to that. And I'd say a lot of my time in the Army has helped develop this approach that I'm speaking to, because we have a greater mission. There's a greater thing going on in the background of all of this that we're trying to do. And there's enjoying one another's company, enjoying the game, enjoying our time spent with friends. The game is a vehicle to that to a certain extent. And so making a mistake in the game that harms the relationship, it's really about mending the relationship and making that better, not just correcting the foul in the game. And so that's where I think that's really important. And it sometimes, you know, you have to make hard decisions. If someone is unable to remain within the boundaries of the professional standards, you need to find ways to address that. Now, I don't agree in just straight up exile or banishment or isolation, because it's just in this case, we're talking about a game. I do think that it is appropriate to cultivate that environment where people can come back from their mistakes and can do better.
This is a great topic.
Yeah. You gotta hold people accountable. And there have been times where you're failing to meet the standard, and it's damaging to the community. It's damaging to the perspective that we're trying to help assert. And you've got to reinforce, you've got to stand, behind what you believe in. And so upholding those standards is crucial, and holding people accountable is as well. But it's also about opportunities to develop and grow as a community. So there's a lot to take in all of that I just said.
Well, it comes back to what you said at the start, and about like being the first one is being people of integrity. One of the biggest points of integrity is practicing what you preach. Like, you can't say, oh, we always want to, somebody's straying outside that integrity. They need to be held accountable. And I think that's something that I think the community's gotten a lot better at, even just in my time in this community. And that is 40K, that is Fantasy, that is Horus Heresy. It's all come such a long way in, say, the last... I've been playing the game again 8 years, maybe 9 years. Yeesh. We're leaps and bounds ahead of where we were. And just thinking about where we're going to be club-wise, team-wise in, another 10 years is phenomenal. Yeah, when I first started playing, the only team that really... Well, sorry, there's two North American teams that I knew of. I didn't know any other names. And it was it No Comp? Team No Comp?
Zero Comp,
Beast Coast, and Beast Coast was the big one that won the ITC team competition every year. And those are the only two. The only reason I knew Team Zero Comp is because two of the people whose podcasts I listen to every week, they were members of that team. And so that was kind of crazy. And now, like, it feels like everybody's like so many people now part of teams and well-known teams. Like,
this game is cooler when you have a shared experience with folks. And like we were talking earlier, I mean, it just gets better and better. And so a team environment, it's not requirement, but it is just sometimes like some of the best 40K is team 40K.
Mm. And it just brings me back to something I strongly believe. And I think that, that our games and the games that we play, tabletop games, are intrinsically there to be shared. That it's not a single player online game where it's just there for your enjoyment. It's there to be shared. It's there to be something worth participating in en masse. And the bigger the better, as far as I'm concerned.
I don't want anything we talked about as far as like what happens when a bad apple happens or whatever to just disrupt people from wanting to get out there and just experience. Like, if you're curious about getting a club together or a team or whatever, just do it, and that will all shake itself out.
It's just life. People come with into our community, especially above and beyond maybe some others, with baggage, with things going on, with mental health stuff. We need to acknowledge that, be there for each other, but when necessary, hold each other to account. And if that means that person has an opportunity to grow and what they do with it, then that's up to them. But I think it's really important that we have these conversations, like on shows like ours, and hopefully that makes it easier for somebody down the track to have a conversation when they need to with something that's going to assist with their club, their team, whatever.
A team, club can be two folks. Like, we're talking about like setting goals on certain things, that it could just be a couple of like-minded folks that get together and paint on Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah,
exactly. Absolutely. Right.
What are you going to say, Rod?
Something that we kind of had brought up over the weekend, I think, in some of our more idle conversations. Another aspect to the community piece is helping to grow and develop it and opening it up to folks. And by doing so, there's a point of, because sometimes teams, you want your teams to be what it is. And I understand not a lot of people are fond of change or adjustment, whether new people join or different groups with, sometimes there's this whole like storming phase of it, right? As a team comes together and it all starts to figure itself out and where that common ground is. And it may not be immediately apparent up front when you're dealing with new or different individuals as they join the community. And so it's something to those that are out there that are trying to grow their community or develop their community to just be very considerate in a lot of regards, right? Respect, dignity towards people and their differences, and figuring that out. And I'm not saying always you just have to go in all cases, but there's definitely the aspect of always being respectful, always doing that dignity. But sometimes it's okay to say, hey, look, like my team, my aspect is, it is what it is, and I'm not looking to expand it. But in a lot of cases, I think that the greater victory, the greater win really is connecting as much of the community together in this broader experience. I mean, you know, how many of these larger events have we gone to where it is awe-inspiring. It's invoking when we see how many people have come together under this banner for our game that we're all playing together, right? And it's there's something to that, and I think something really great to be harnessed from that. And that's where I just, in the spirit of community building, that whole dignity and respect thing, it's, you know, I know, you know, teams can get together and there's inside jokes and there's all sorts of other aspects, but just really trying to lean into that will do some real wonders for the development of a community in the long run.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, talk about how to beat Necrons and maybe some hobby stuff. See you all in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games, Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody, we are back. Thank you very much for checking out our sponsors. In the line, also with kind of the mental health angle that we kind of just briefly mentioned in the last segment, buddy and friend of the show, Simon, is running a tournament that's going to be happening actually in Warhammer World. It's going to be his Rally Point tournament that benefits mental health group. And I'll put a link in the show notes to anybody who's interested in the area that can show up and support it, and or maybe just want to play in the tournament. I'll definitely put a link there. I think that kind of stuff is important. Anytime we can raise any kind of awareness on that kind of stuff, it would be cool. I have something in the works as well that would be more just a almost like a raffle type thing. I don't want to overpromise because I've been thinking about it for a while, but I'm trying to, you know, kind of put the actions where the heart is, kind of thing. So maybe more to come on that later on. But while we got you here, let's talk about how to defeat this silver menace.
Or in my case, bone and bread.
People know what menace we're talking about. The Necron's been tearing it up. Even Necron losses put up impressive points on the scoreboard. And so it's, you know, you're going to be fighting for your life the whole way, even if you do manage to get a win. And so what can the average player do to disrupt the scoring of the Necron opponent? And so maybe important, let's highlight, everybody knows what the primaries are, but there's a few secondaries that they seem to be kind of advantaged in scoring.
So, I mean, I understand what you're saying. People are doing well with them, but I
don't. Maybe
also
because
say
folks
that,
don't know how to interact with them. So let's detail what the secondaries are, and then we'll maybe solution for it.
So we'll start with my favorite, honestly, is Code of Combat. At the end of the battle, the first bullet is score 3 victory points for each enemy unit that was destroyed by a ranged attack made by a Necron's noble unit from your army during the battle. The next bullet point is score 4 victory points for each enemy unit that was destroyed by a melee attack made by a Necron's noble unit from your army during the battle. In addition, each time an enemy character unit is destroyed by a melee attack made by a Necron's noble unit from your army, gain 1 command point. And so it's pretty big, because at the end of the battle, you're just tallying up all the units that were killed, and it's just slapped together, which means there's no limitation for how many can be earned per turn. Mm-hmm. There's no limitation to, you know, it's 7 points a turn, or you can only get 1 melee and 1 shooting per turn. It's just such a big deal.
Yeah, and there's like literally no ceiling on this thing. I've seen people get 12 points on this in a turn. It's kind of nuts.
And this goes back to the core of it, a Necron noble unit, ideally the Silent King in so many of these newer builds. The Silent King just puts out so many shots and so much melee. I found it very easy to carve out roughly 10 points in a turn if I set it up right, just because you could weaken something down. And then, of course, there's like the Necron stratagem where you pay 1 CP and then it automatically wounds a target. And mm-hmm. so you just go straight to the save and
yeah. take
and
these six wounds from this Mineer.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Six damage, right? It's huge. And so it's just such a big deal because the Silent King is so effective. If it wasn't for the Silent King, if it was any other group of nobles, you would need to have multiple nobles to pull this off because destroyers and cryptex don't count as nobles. It's all about this very specific line of other unnamed characters. A few of them can be named, like Anrakir the Traveler or Imhotep, but it still doesn't relate, in my opinion, to what the Silent King is capable of. And so with this, it seems pretty clear you can't score if you don't have a Necron Noble unit to do it. Therefore, pretty quick turnaround in just removing the nobles from the fight. Some people may say easier said than done because like the Silent King, being that he's 16 wounds himself and then each Menhir is 5 wounds, those Menhirs are all together, he's 26, but since no one model is 18 wounds or more, he can be behind obscured terrain and can defend himself pretty well through that. Hmm. Beyond that, he gets, I mean, I think he's really, he is a force multiplier of significant degree. However, he's not as strong as a knight that's rotated shields, and plenty of people have taken down knights in one turn. And for him, you know, this sounds silly when I say it. I know this sounds silly when I say it. Take him down by 19 wounds. You destroy two Menhirs and you take him down beyond his threshold of 8 wounds. And he starts to lose attacks. He starts to lose capabilities that he would have had those had he not been taken down to that point. So it becomes important to focus on that in order to remove him better. So given all that, if you remove the king or you remove the nobles, they can't score the secondary. And I think that's something important for people to remember because even with Chaos Knights out there, I would say a lot of the cases of the meta that I've seen, I've not seen too many that have really leaned forward into the aspect of you know, destroying something like a knight or the Silent King for that matter. And so I know that in the current meta, I think there is an adjustment coming by the players and what they're playing in the meta in order to accommodate this threat.
Hmm. So you're saying cut off the head. I love it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Further to that, I mean, we've kind of made some assumptions of knowledge of people listening to this, but it's important to identify with Necrons about why they are so potent, why they are winning, and why they are really strong. And there's kind of three things you can have in 9th edition that will make you stand out, or three types of things we have seen that make armies better than their peers. The first one is you just have one or two absolutely cranked, overpowered, overtuned data sheets. Case in point, Harlequins with the Void Weavers upon release, Orcs with the Buggies upon release. There were single data sheets that were so strong and oppressive, possibly, that they were enough to make them stand above their peers. The other one would be stratagems or levels of durability. A case in point there would be custodies upon release, where they could, you know, be, you have no rerolls and transhuman and all these things, that they would just survive long enough to win games intuitively. And Necrons bring a very interesting set that I don't think we've seen at this level before. We have a concept that we came upon in 9th edition called, and I'm using quotation, my air quotes right now, called the bus stop list, as in they don't need to interact with you to score, to have a winning score, to score more than you, to outscore you. And what Necrons bring is not data sheets or oppressiveness in any way upon which they have in their army. They bring it by scoring ability, sheer enormous ability to score points. So many points that no matter what some armies have available to them secondaries wise, you can't catch them. And that's what they bring. It's a very unique thing, and I don't think we've seen any other army in 9th edition have a higher scoring ability ceiling. Like I refer back to, I used to play Dark Angels, and we were, air quotes, a bus stop list. A lot of the time you take Stubborn Defiance, you would take To the Last, you would sit in your deployment zone and score 80 points, you know, without moving after deployment. You could just score 80 points. Necrons will score 100 doing very little to you. Code of Combat is the most the thing that they need to interact with you the most. And even then, you get like 10, 12 points just killing your screens with the Silent King over 5 turns, you know? It's kind of nuts. Just the scoreboard they'll put upon you. I think, is there a team in American football that would just outscore their opponent? They had their defense wasn't great, but their offense was so cranked that they just put a scoreboard on people they couldn't contend with. Like, anyone famous for that? I don't know.
There's several instances. There's a couple dynasties out there as far as, like, and by dynasty I mean like the football teams. But there are a few I can think of some years or seasons in which there have been teams like that. But nothing like none of them maintain that character long enough to say like this one team is only like that.
Well, sure. And like we don't expect this to hold fire for Necrons there. We're like this is probably 3 to 6 months of Necrons being the best scoring faction in the competition, in the meta. And it might go on. Other teams, other factions might come up to be of the same level, same ilk. But right now, you have to stop them scoring or you can't win. You don't have to remove models. You don't have to kill them. You don't have, apart from, you know, code of combat, like Red has just said, you just need to stop them. You just need to stop them racking up the points.
Identifying how these are made. I mean, they could be rounds that go by with the Necron players just like racking up points, and you're like, what's going on? I'm like, well, I got 35 on this objective, so you know.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Knowing what the actual components of that are and explaining it goes a long way to how to forming a plan to stop it. And everybody's army maybe have different capabilities, but if you know, I guess I can take, you know, possible, maybe by the point this goes down, 5 points off my opponent's score by finishing off every noble, then that's maybe one of my priorities.
Exactly right. Yep.
Exactly. And that's where I think, you know, Adam, you've laid out this really great boogeyman with the Necrons, and I appreciate it because I need it to travel a little bit further, because we have to recognize it did take 3 data sheets to get here, right? And I don't think that it's necessarily that bad of a thing, because the adjustments made and everything, I really do think that there is a matter of correction, and not by the rules themselves. I do think that there's a matter of correction in the meta itself. I think that people need to adjust themselves to Nephilim and not necessarily just keep trying to play the army that they thought was winning in Nachmund or before that. And so people just have to adjust. There's a shifting in the fact that we are playing an entirely new season right now. Mm. And so the fact that Necrons rose up into that and they got the buffs from the data sheet. Yeah, you like that? They got the buffs from the balance sheet, and then they also got the secondaries from Nephilim. It's almost like someone intended that to a certain extent, right? Like the game designers maybe leaned towards that direction. And I think that's fair. And I think it's actually a really good demonstration of game design and the ability to say, we're going to flip this lever here. We're going to turn this switch here, and we're going to do this, this, and this. And now we've actually taken an army with, because when you think about it, this list that I'm running now with 2 destroyer squads, Scarabs, 2 Satan, the Silent King, Technomancers, I was building this list 2 years ago. We were just in a time with COVID and everything else. And even then, it wasn't as good because we didn't have core as proliferate as it is now. The king wasn't core by any means, of course. And so we were dealing with different limitations and structures. And then we also had COVID going on where people didn't play against it, right? I think we've talked about it before where I think AdMech kind of got away from it ran away with itself because there weren't people really getting to play it in mass. And so the meta didn't really get a chance to adjust due to other circumstances. And I think that right now people need to slow down the alarms on how strong or how intense Necrons are and really think about the game and what they're doing to stop it. And I guess, you know, continuing with some of the other secondaries, these two are pretty similar. The Ancient Machineries and Treasures of Aeons. And they're similar in the regards that it's objective focused, very objective focused. The Treasures of Aeons is about holding objectives. And a key thing here is at the end of your turn, you score victory points if you control one or more of those selected objectives. So it's at the end of the turn, which is pretty big because you can take your entire turn just trying to clean off the objectives you need in order to do it. And so to further explain for Treasures of Aeons, if you select this objective during the resolve pre-battle ability step of the mission, your opponent must select three objective markers on the battlefield. When doing so, they cannot select objective markers that are in their deployment zone unless they have already selected all objective markers that are in no man's land. And then, you know, I said at the end of the turn, they score depending on how many objective markers you hold that were selected. And it's if you hold one of those objectives, you get 2 points. If you hold two of those, you get 3 points. And this is huge. If you hold three, you get 5. So then you take into account Necrons using Eternal Conquerors and Relentlessly Expansionists, which are two custom traits that come together to make what I call the Obsec Dynasty, as I've mentioned before, where they have Obsec and they also move out 6 inches, which gives them a real lead in the pregame move of being able to get up front and get on these objectives to score treasures. You have to prevent them from taking those objectives. I mean, that's really it. And I would say a lot of armies right now are not geared for just, as we talked about, the durability of the Necrons right now and what they do. They didn't get more durable thanks to the data. The data sheet didn't say they get Armor of Contempt. It didn't say they get additional reanimation protocols. They didn't get any of that. There has been an element of durability, but now you have mission sets that actually play into that durability and their ability to just hang on to it. And so now you've really got to have your own army's capability to remove them from that objectives. And I'd say in a lot of the games that I've played recently, I haven't seen people really leaning towards that, whether it was in their list construction from the get-go or if they even had the capability, but they chose not to really focus on it because they were fighting some other part of the list. So I think that's pretty big.
A term we see thrown around in a lot of sports and a lot of other competitions is the line of play, as in the line of decision-making that will get you the result that you want. And I think that the line of play versus Necrons is so distinctly different to others is what's causing everyone problems. And especially in the Nuckmint packet, the line of play was usually establish your board presence over the first two turns and make sure you get a baseline of scoring underway. Put up your banners, get your first R&D, try an R&D, one of the harder quarters to do turn one, or get your first couple of ticks over on whatever secondaries you've got, get your buffs up, etc. The line of play versus Necrons is the opposite of that. Get to their side of the, get to the other side of the halfway point of the table early and start establishing presence on their objectives. Well, on the objectives on their half of the table.
And kill those nobles.
And kill those nobles if you can. Yeah, absolutely. Start building options into your list. Maybe we start seeing those big units of eradicators again. You put those big units of eradicators back into your list, that Silent King has to stay behind. He has to stay being a buff piece rather than being a piece that comes out and buffs and kills and shoots and kills and charges and kills, you know? Start getting some respect back from the Necron player, because the way I see it, they don't have to respect your army. They can just go about their business and win the game with very little sweat, you know, coming off their brow in the five turns of doing.
For sure. I mean, I think that they can do that. I think that it's not necessarily in all their best interests, but they can. They definitely can make it very difficult if you don't have a list that can really influence and do certain things. It can make it difficult. What I do like is a lot of the armies are starting to have things that can do stuff like turning off Obsec or the Chaos Knights dread tests and things like that. And so armies are starting to have more what we might call indirect effects or influences upon their adversaries or their opponents. And so some of those things, like the ability to stop them from moving on to objective or to take away their obsec or to reduce fear so that when you actually do, you know, reduce leadership so that when you actually do hit them, it causes that much more in morale and combat attrition. And so those kinds of things, I think, are starting to take some more prominence, which again goes into, as we're talking about, like how to fight and remove the Necrons from the field. We talk about this other objective, Ancient Machineries. You have to do an action on an objective, and they have to be the no man. They can't be the one in your deployment zone. But when you do this action, it gives you 4 victory points each time that is conducted. So, you know, in 4 turns, you have 16 points. You've maxed it at 15. And it's really not difficult to do because at the end of your movement phase, one Necron's core or Necron's canoptic unit from your army can start to perform this action if it is within range of an objective marker you control that is not within your deployment zone, which has not already been awakened. If the unit performing this action has the objective secured ability, which, you know, if your entire army has objective secured, that action is completed at the end of your turn. Otherwise, it is completed at the start of your next command phase. And so that's where you see a lot of the Necrons taking that objective secured ability as a trait for the whole thing, and it gives a lot of leeway in it. It's a great, I actually prefer that one over treasures personally. I know not other people don't necessarily agree, but because we go back to this whole durability aspect I was talking about, and because the fact that I really feel, again, going back to the focus of players in Nephilim right now, I don't feel like many players have focused on my scoring of objectives. It's not that they just resign themselves to it, but they really are playing, they're not playing Nephilim, in my opinion. They haven't caught up to the fact that you have to stop my secondaries or else I will run away with it in a lot of regards.
That's what which this I podcast think is about. Important. At least this segment anyway is about how to stop the secondary.
Right.
Like the scoring, right. Interact with your opponent in a way that has not been present yet.
Yeah.
To keep them from scoring points. And there, in Necrons, we're targeting them right now, but the same can be true of Adeptus Auritas and some other factions out there that can kind of score these points.
Absolutely.
Playing their own game. How to get in there and be disruptive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Death Guard, Sisters, and Orcs are three other factions that have really, that have some secondaries that they can really take advantage of. They might not agree that they're as good as Necrons to an extent, but I also, again, I think Necrons sort of dark horse the meta with Nephilim, and I think that people are still reeling and trying to adapt and overcome to it.
Communicating with your opponents big too. You know, when they break down, what are your secondaries? Ask them exactly, you know, what they have to do to satisfy the conditions to get points. Sometimes it's variable points. It could be you only get 1, 2, or 3 points. You know, you want to know that too. See if there's any way you can really put a tourniquet, you know, on your point hemorrhaging.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, and that, so to that, one that I think is actually one of the easier ones to stop, it's their Battlefield Supremacy secondary called Purge the Vermin. I actually think it's good. I take it quite often, especially given that I was using the objective secured and relentlessly expansionist, which gave me the 6-inch pre-game move. It is, at the end of your turn, score 1 victory point for each table quarter that has no enemy units wholly within it, and then also score 1 victory point if there are no enemy units wholly within your deployment zone. And so, in a lot of cases, you know, right out from the start, with that 6-inch move, you're able to move up and just occupy that much more of the board. And you find yourself just kicking off the first round even right there with 3 points. And then it's just how you shift the army and how you hold down what you have to continue to just score 3 at almost at minimum, typically 3 points. I think I rarely scored less than 3, maybe 2 consistently, but it does really well. And so to go to stopping that, it's just the reverse of engage, right? It's like, I think like the old stranglehold. You just need to put units in those quarters. And once they're wholly within, it doesn't matter if they're, again, Gretchen or whatever random unit out there that just gets in there. It immediately takes that point away, and you can start carving into the secondaries by doing that. You just have to have the right tools to make that happen.
You know, be proactive, interact, kill the nobles, figure out, you know, what, because all these things, we say they're auto points, but there's not. There is something that has to happen. Some are very difficult to interact with, though. Like the guard, have your tanks within what distance of a tank commander?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You just need to understand where those ranges are and what you're trying to do. Yeah.
And take them out. You know, focus on that and then attack the scoreboard. Right. You know, that's one of the things we kind of give counsel to players when they are maybe behind on points in a game is figure out exactly how to attack the scoreboard.
Yeah. And honestly, I feel like part of that with the Necrons is that you should be doing that from the very beginning and you should not stop.
Agreed.
Yeah, good advice. Let's talk a little bit about a hobby segment. Like, and I'll be honest, I've been in a bit of a hobby slump. I don't know if people follow me on Twitter or Instagram, but it's been real dry coming out of my feed for working.
It's a wasteland.
And so I decided to change that. decided. Really, though, you know, we're kind of fresh off a tournament, like with the ATC, and there's a little bit of hobby work that went into that, and of course, you know, kind of event driven with a lot of my hobby preparedness. And decide, and since I don't have another one that I'm going to for playing in for the next little bit, I think that's kind of slowed me down as far as like what I'm getting actually on the table. So I decided to change that. That knight list I was working on is about 80% there. I'm like, I have three more knights of the smaller knights I have to paint too, and they go together super quick. What's stopping me? Nothing. Nothing but the opportunity. Decided to jump on an opportunity. Realized I didn't do a very good job cleaning my airbrush since the last time I used it.
Uh-oh.
And what does that mean? It means that airbrush didn't work. So I have to clean the airbrush, go to clean the airbrush, trying to multitask like an idiot, and drop the nozzle, and it's lost for like an hour.
Oh, no.
So the hobby time that I was going to put the base coat and the chipping medium and that kind of stuff on the models, completely consumed with looking for the piece of nozzle that if I was just paying attention, or maybe not cleaning my airbrush, trying to multitask, could have been spent paint. This is a cautionary tale. This is the hobby segment's cautionary tale.
It is. Yeah.
So how do you, I guess the question would be like, how do you find motivation to paint when you maybe are in a bit of a slump? So I find that my slumps are usually coincide with me feeling a little bit overwhelmed with the sheer quantity of stuff that I have in my pile of shame.
Pile of potential. That's the new way.
I am like fueled by shame, so I'm going to keep calling it a Fair. Pile of shame. So I actually did something this week that really helped me to like visualize a plan of like what I can actually do to whittle down my pile of shame. And I took an inventory of everything. I took an inventory of what I have painted already. I took an inventory of things that I have assembled and not painted. And I took an inventory of things that I have new in the box. And I made like a Trello board of it. I don't know if you ever used it. It's
no,
like,
what's a Trello board?
So it's software that you use for project management with a team. And I like it because you can move things around. So once I build a kit, then I can like move it over into like the paint section. And then when I paint something, it's like checking it off the list. I can move it over to like the completed section. And having these lists is like a visual for me to sort of maintain my momentum. Checking things off of lists is highly motivating for me. So it took, I think, I mean, this is how much shame I have. It took me 2 days to go through all of my stuff and make all these boards because they're all separated by faction, right? So I've got like orcs, guard, space wolves, custodies, night haunt, ogres. I got my Escher stuff. And then I have a bunch of like weird, like one-off models, just like sort of models just to paint. And so I've categorized everything and now my anxiety is much lessened.
That's cool. The checkoff of a list thing is an actual real thing too. So if anybody's out there looking for that, how to kind of keep the juices flowing or whatever, that is a great method. And even to the point of they're saying, like, put things on the list you're going to do anyway. Like, have your morning coffee. Check, you know?
Honestly, you get this, like, little hit of, like, happy chemicals in your brain, and you can just, like, keep that momentum going by just, you know, it makes you feel like you've accomplished something. Even if it's something esoteric that you can't, like, you don't have a physical thing in front of you that you've completed, but there's a lot of mental work and things that you do in the day that accumulate onto your daily load. So having a checklist means that you can actually see that I have completed this thing.
Yeah. Waiting till you're motivated to do something is a trap. The things just won't get done. You will, there's like more reasons not to be motivated than there are motivated to do something you're not particularly jazzed about doing. Mm-hmm. Or even if you do like doing it, you might not be jazzed then about it, and so it delays your progress. You kind of got to figure out ways to trick yourself into getting through those slumps.
Mm-hmm. How about you guys? Is there anything that you do to sort of restart your hobby will?
I actually mentioned one of the ones I've started using recently before. I go to the club. I'd line up my slump with like going to my gaming club and like having a burger and talking some crap. But that's when I'm already got a project I'm working on. So how do I get up from a slump? Red, you got one?
Yeah, so I mean, and having bounced around between different aspects, Tanya, you mentioned having lists and everything. For me, laying it out really does help me visualize better of what I'm looking at. Because if it's all in pieces or it's all in parts and it's packed away here or there, you never really get this idea of where the end of it is, or it's harder to break it into pieces or components of the whole. And so that's something that has helped is being able to visualize and see what I'm trying to do, see the scope and scale of it, and understand what resources I might have, what assistance I might have to get there, and what I'm going to do with it. And so there's a lot to that. I think the other thing is really, for me, it's not necessarily always just going with what is out there in the meta, not always going out there, finding something that I truly enjoy about it and that I want to put my effort into. I could see where I would likely get significantly burn out if I was having to constantly build and play into the meta by itself.
That's a good one. I think if it's a hobby project, like it's a new army or something, I like to associate starting a new project with a new technique or a new line of paint or something, a point of growth, like a specific point of growth that I'm going to try and achieve through this new project. And that helps me get excited to start a new thing or get out of a slump. A lot of the times I'll look up tutorials and see how other people paint something similar, and then think up something that I'm going to do specifically for mine to make it my own, but also push myself and add a bit of spice. Because despite my outward appearance as a deeply competitive player, which I am, I love the hobby. I paint, well, for like Paul has said, for every hour you play, you probably paint for 10, you know? And that's definitely true for me. So painting is the bigger part of my hobby, and it needs to be enjoyable. And so when it's grinding, it usually means it's not fun. I'm not enjoying what I'm doing, or I'm just doing something I've done a million times. So I need to inject something different into it. And so people might see it with some of my larger armies, like my Cadian army. You'll see there is like one half of it is painted like literally to Duncan Rhodes, like Warhammer TV's painting guide that he did like freaking 8 years ago now. And then about 120 infantry into that army, you'll see it change. stuff like that. If something is really grinding me down and I just can't get the mojo up to continue a scheme, it's okay to do same but different if it means it's gonna get the job done.
There we go. That's a great place to pause it. Good discussions all around, I think, this week. Appreciate everybody listening. Please don't forget to leave some 5-star reviews, like, share, and subscribe if you have not already. Leave some comments if you listen to us on YouTube. That's a cool place to interact as well. We'll see y'all next week.
They said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.